ideas and glorious culture to students who couldn't care less, not so much. Indeed, the charade degrades students, teachers, and the subjects themselves. Opera is divine, but herding rock fans into opera houses is not only futile, but cruel. Many educators assuage their consciences by insisting youthful force-feeding will, in time, blossom into mature fascination. Even if they're right, the force-feeding is a regrettable pathway to the merit good of mature fascination, not a merit good in itself. How does actually existing education measure up against these standards of merit? As long as you've had a vaguely typical education, you already know the answer. The content of education is mixed at best. Pockets of greatness surrounded by insipid busy work. The pedagogy is poor. Frankly, most teachers are boring. The students are worse. No matter how great their teachers, few yearn for the life of the mind. Private education is arguably slightly better, but it's cut from the same cloth as public education. Harvard University's Steven Pinker sadly reports that the best students in the world yawn at the best teachers in the world. A few weeks into every semester, I face a lecture hall that is half empty, despite the fact that I am repeatedly voted a Harvard Yearbook favorite professor, that the lectures are not video recorded, and that they are the only source of certain material that will be on the exam. I don't take it personally. It's common knowledge that Harvard students stay away from lectures in droves, burning a $50 bill from their parents' wallets every time they do. When I judge our education hollow, it isn't just my opinion. It's very likely your opinion, too. Honestly, how many educators do you find fascinating? Do you really think kids find them any more fascinating than you do? Even those who refuse to voice the unseemly answers speak the unvarnished truth with their behavior. Modern education's staunchest fans don't nourish their souls by watching YouTube videos of average teachers. No one does. The empirics on student boredom we've covered underscore the obvious. Stimulating education is the exception that proves the rule. While the humanist critique of Philistine economists rings true, economists have a punchy comeback. Cost matters. Suppose opera really is good for the soul, and education genuinely promotes love of opera. These facts mean little until we know the per capita cost of conversion. Exposing a single person to opera is worth any expense is bravado. Cost matters whenever you spend your own money. How could cost cease to matter when you spend taxpayer money? Every dollar spent is a dollar that could have been repurposed. This economistic comeback is now more compelling than ever. Ours is an age of science fiction. Almost everyone in rich countries and about half the Earth's population can access machines that answer virtually any question and teach virtually every subject. The Internet doesn't merely satisfy our curiosities. It connects us to global communities that share our curiosities. These global communities are more than clubs of novices. They include many of the greatest teachers on the planet. The Internet provides not just stream of consciousness enlightenment, but outstanding formal coursework. This ceaseless intellectual feast is, with rare exceptions, free of charge. If education is a merit good, the Internet is the merit machine. On reflection, this merit machine is swiftly making traditional humanist education policy obsolete. Once everyone can enrich their souls for free, government subsidies for enrichment forfeit their rationale. To object, "But most people don't use the Internet for spiritual enrichment," is actually a damaging admission that eager students are few and far between. Subsidized education's real aim isn't to make ideas and culture accessible to anyone who's interested, but to make them mandatory for everyone who isn't interested. The rise of the Internet also undercuts the Machiavellian line that intellectual force-feeding ultimately blossoms into sincere appreciation. Today's adults are the product of over a decade of mandatory exposure to abstract ideas and high culture. If educational force-feeding worked well, most educated adults would adore these nerdy realms and eagerly tap the Internet to revisit them. To understate, they rarely do. Kim Kardashian gets about 20 times as many Google hits as Richard Wagner, and about 200 times as many as David Hume. Insisting the end justifies the means is comical when progress toward the end is barely visible. A Philistine could reply, "Of course adults rarely bother studying ideas and culture online. There's no money in it." But this chapter is not aimed at Philistines, but at anyone who defends actually existing education as good for the soul. The rise of the internet has two unsettling lessons for them. First, the humanist case for education subsidies is flimsy today because the internet makes enlightenment practically free. Second, the humanist case for education subsidies was flimsy all along because the internet proves low consumption of ideas and culture stems from apathy, not poverty or inconvenience. Behold, when the price of enlightenment drops to zero, enlightenment remains embarrassingly scarce. The soulful fallback. Education does not have to be justified solely on the basis of its effect on labor productivity. This was certainly not the argument given by Plato or de Tocqueville, and need not be ours. Students are not taught civics or art or music solely in order to improve their labor productivity, but rather to enrich their lives and make them better citizens. Andrew Weiss, Human Capital versus Signaling Explanations of Wages. There are intermediate positions between Philistine and humanist. Restrained educational idealists could fault the humanist tradition for overemphasizing students' inner lives. Sure, students rarely feel their souls being enriched. But why not pragmatically equate enriching the soul with fostering desirable adult attitudes and behavior? From this perspective, education is good for the soul counts as true as long as education appreciably shifts society in the right direction. This is a tempting fallback position, so let's delve into it. Identifying the right direction for societal change is up to the listener. Ballparking education's effect on society, however, is up to me. To preview, education does seem to shift students' values, though less than teachers and parents advertise. To isolate education's influence on society, however, you must unpack how education sways students. Is the mechanism leadership, planting teachers' ideas in students' heads? Then education remolds society. Is the mechanism peer effects, sorting kids into distinct groups? Then education mainly reshuffles society without remolding it. Suppose you funnel an extra kid into college. The student's peer group seismically shifts. Given human conformity, the freshman will likely try to blend in with these new peers. College youths are less religious, for example, so one would expect the student to veer in a secular direction. This does not imply, however, that college makes society less religious. The existence of college splits kids into two subcultures with opposing peer effects. If college kids are less religious than average kids, then non-college kids must be more religious than average kids. Members of each subculture adjust their behavior to locally fit in. Religious conformity pressure in the non-college pool offsets secular pressure in the college pool. Net effect on society's religiosity, unclear, even if college demonstrably makes students less religious. Leadership and peer effects both exist, but there are three hefty reasons to think peer effects outweigh leadership. First, on dimensions where academic leadership seems most intense, education's effect on attitudes and behavior is mild. Second, although schools focus their preaching on a handful of issues, education sways attitudes and behavior on many dimensions. Indeed, as we shall soon see, educated opinion occasionally spurns the pedagogical consensus. Third, individual and social effects rarely add up. Boosting an individual's education usually changes that individual far more than boosting a society's education changes that society. High culture falls on deaf ears. Educators hope to enrich the soul in 100 different ways. But there's one form of enrichment high school and college pursues more explicitly and energetically than any other, instilling appreciation for high culture. English classes push classic novels, plays, and poetry. William Shakespeare, Washington Irving, Edgar Allan Poe, Mark Twain, Edith Wharton, Sinclair Lewis, Robert Frost. Music classes push traditional music, especially classical. Antonio Vivaldi, Ludwig van Beethoven, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and above all, John Philip Sousa. Art classes are more hands-on, but still try to raise the status of visual works in top museums. Even schools' iconoclasm is conservative. Academic curricula often cover Kurt Vonnegut, Arnold Schoenberg, or Jackson Pollock, but rarely George R.R. Martin, Lady Gaga, or Frank Miller. Though some schools promote high culture more energetically than others, curricula are plainly tilted against pop culture. How effectively has this tilt fostered high culture? Earlier in the audiobook, I appealed to the truism that education can't be responsible for more than 100% of what we know. The same principle allows us to set an upper bound on education's cultural impact. Education can't be responsible for more than 100% of the high culture our society consumes. Let's start with books. Consumer demand is shockingly low overall. Americans spend 0.2% of their income on all reading materials, barely more than $100 per family per year. Americans used to spend more on reading, but never spent much. Back in 1990, well before the rise of the web, reading absorbed 0.5% of the family budget. Today's Americans spend about four times as much on tobacco and five times as much on alcohol as they do on reading. Within this small pond, high culture is no big fish. Let's consider the rankings on three popular lists of the best-selling English language fiction of all time, Wikipedia, Ranker, and How Stuff Works. Sales figures include school purchases and assigned texts, so they overstate sincere affection for the canon. While sales figures are plainly flawed, all three lists paint similar pictures of the public's long-run literary tastes. High culture is but a niche market. Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities tops two of the three lists. The Catcher in the Rye, Ben-Hur, To Kill a Mockingbird, Gone with the Wind, and Lolita all appear on at least one list. But fantasy, Tolkien, Rowling, Lewis, dominates. The point is not that fantasy lacks literary merit. By my lights, Lord of the Rings towers over Catcher in the Rye. The point is that the books high school and college hail for their supreme literary merit lose out to much less prestigious genres. By and large, literature teachers fail to get through to their captive audiences. They rarely spark love of reading, much less love of the genres they urge their students to admire. In music, pop culture's victory over high culture is even more decisive. The Three Tenors in Concert is the best-selling classical album ever. With 12 million copies sold, it does not even break into the top 50 albums of all time. Looking at overall sales, classical music is only 1.4% of the U.S. music market. Country is 8 times as popular, and rock pop over 30 times as popular. Classical does better globally, but still only commands a 5% share of the world's music marketplace. Well, at least it beats jazz. The point is not that classical music alone is aesthetically worthwhile. Bad Religion isn't Bach, but it's good. The point is that schools' aesthetic priorities have negligible cultural impact. Even if American schools cause all U.S. consumption of classical music, their combined efforts boost its market share only from 0% to 1.4%. Why is high culture so marginalized? Humanists may be tempted to blame poor salesmanship. Students would love Shakespeare and Brahms had they only the right teachers. The straightforward story, though, is that high culture requires extra mental effort to appreciate, and most humans resent mental effort. Students are overwhelmingly bored by Shakespeare, and the rare fans of high culture would probably have come to love the bard on their own. Students sample a little high culture when their grades depend on it. Once they submit their final exams, however, the vast majority of students rush back to their lowbrow comfort zone. Anyone listening to this audiobook is probably a bird of a different feather. You may even remember the names of the teachers who opened your eyes to the finer things in life. I owe my love of classical music to Mr. Zahner, general music, 7th grade, and my love of literature to Mrs. Regus, honors English, 11th grade. A quick look at the basic facts, however, shows our experiences are abnormal. The vast majority of our classmates emerge from years of cultural force-feeding with their aesthetic palettes unchanged. The paper tiger of political correctness. American educators lean left. There's no denying it. The party breakdown for K through 12 public school teachers is lopsided, roughly 45% Democrat, 25% Independent, and 30% Republican. The breakdown for college faculty is starkly lopsided. A national representative study of all professors, including professors in two-year colleges, finds 51% Democrats, 35% Independents, and 14% Republicans. A similar study of four-year college faculty reports 50% Democrats, 39% Independents other, and 11% Republicans. Left-wing dominance seems even stronger at elite schools. Colleges are least balanced in the most politically charged subjects, with about 5 Democrats per Republican in the humanities and 8 Democrats per Republican in the social sciences. As recently as 2006, 5% of humanities professors and 18% of social scientists were self-described Marxists. The ratio of liberals to conservatives is less extreme, presumably because, unlike party affiliation, these are relative terms. When 18% of their colleagues are Marxists, many mainstream Democrats understandably feel moderate by comparison. None of this proves teachers and professors use their classrooms to enlighten or brainwash their students. But the conditions for enlightenment / brainwashing are most auspicious. Educators' distinctive worldview provides a compelling motive to mold students' minds. Captive student audiences provide a golden opportunity to mold students' minds. Even if teachers avoid blatant proselytizing, ideological neutrality requires Vulcan self-discipline. Won't the subtlest slant maintained year after year win students' hearts and minds in the end? Apparently not. In the data, the well-educated are only microscopically more liberal. In the general social survey, people place themselves on a 7-step scale where 1 is extremely liberal, 4 is moderate, and 7 is extremely conservative. An extra year of education seems to make people 0.014 steps more liberal. Taken literally, over 70 years of education are required to shift ideology a single step. Statistical corrections make this effect look stronger, but it stays weak. If the effect on ideology is slight, the effect on partisanship is perverse. As education rises, people grow slightly less democratic. The general social survey's respondents place themselves on a 7-step scale where 0 is strong Democrat, 3 is independent, and 6 is strong Republican. An extra year of education seems to make people 0.071 steps more Republican. Statistical corrections make this effect look weaker, but education still appears to mildly boost support for the party that teachers and professors disfavor. The plot thickens when you analyze education's effect on specific opinions. Abundant research confirms education raises support for civil liberties and tolerance and reduces racism and sexism. These effects are only partly artifactual. Correcting for intelligence cuts education's impact by about a third. Correcting for intelligence, income, occupation, and family background slices education's impact in half. All corrections made, education fosters a package of socially liberal views. At the same time, abundant research also confirms education raises support for capitalism, free markets, and globalization. These effects, too, are partly artifactual. Correcting for intelligence cuts education's impact by about 40%. Correcting for intelligence, income, demographics, party, and ideology halves it. But when all corrections are done, education fosters a package of economically conservative views. If educators are as left-wing as they seem, why would education have such contradictory effects on students' stances? The charitable story is that educators keep their politics out of the classroom. The more plausible story, though, is that educators are unpersuasive. The Jesuits say, "Give me the child until he is seven, and I'll give you the man." Society gives liberal educators the child until he's 15, 18, 22, or 30. But issue by issue, teachers are about as likely to repel their students as attract them. Educators could protest, "The problem isn't that we're unpersuasive, but that students are stubborn." But students revise their opinions all the time. The longer they stay in school, the more they revise. They just don't revise in a reliably liberal direction. Critics who highlight educators' leftist leanings usually have an ideological axe to grind, or swing. Leaving education of the young in the hands of politically correct ideologues endangers our democracy. School should be a vibrant marketplace of ideas, not a center for indoctrination. Though they're right about the imbalance, it's a paper tiger. Even extreme left-wing dominance leaves little lasting impression. Contrary to the indoctrination story, education doesn't progressively dye students ever brighter shades of red. Since education raises social liberalism and economic conservatism, neither liberals nor conservatives should cheer or jeer education's effect on our political culture. What about people who are both socially liberal and economically conservative? Should they admit that education really is good for the soul after all? It's complicated. If teachers aren't molding their students, the logical inference is that students are molding each other. But peer effects, to repeat, are double-edged. When schools cluster socially liberal, economically conservative youths inside the ivory tower, they inadvertently but automatically cluster socially conservative, economically liberal youths outside the ivory tower. If education is good for the souls of the former, it's bad for the souls of the latter. Net effect on the polity? Ambiguous. But doesn't knowledge of history lead us to support wiser policies, both foreign and domestic? This is true almost by definition. Someone who understood history deeply enough would be able to sift through their knowledge of the past, find the relevant parallels, and skillfully apply it to the issues of the day. Yet this hardly shows that actually existing historical education has these wondrous effects. Indeed, we already have two strong reasons to doubt the political benefits of history classes. First, despite years of study, most adults are historically illiterate. Either they never learned basic history, or they swiftly forgot what they learned. If a world of historical ignorance is scary, you should be scared already, because that's where we live. Second, humans' ability to transfer knowledge from one domain to another, such as from history to policy, is poor. When Bush invaded Iraq, was he ignoring the lesson of the Vietnam War or heeding the lesson of the Korean War? So even if citizens knew the details of history, it is far from clear they'd fruitfully apply their knowledge. Getting out the vote. Voting is a bipartisan tenet of our secular religion. It doesn't matter how you vote, but vote, educators say it loud, proud, early, and often. Staunchly partisan teachers plead with their students to vote, silently hoping they'll vote correctly. Genuinely apolitical teachers are often equally insistent. Democracy is at stake. K through 12 teachers probably preach the duty to vote more energetically than college professors, but the whole education system reads from the same prayer book. Do their sermons work? It's complicated. Voter turnout rises sharply with education. Substantial effects of education on turnout usually linger after statistically correcting for income, demographics, intelligence, and so on. Despite some thoughtful naysayers, limited experimental data also show extra education boosts turnout. The catch? Education has sharply risen over the last century, but turnout has gently fallen. This could mean offsetting factors masked education's pro-voting effect, but several prominent researchers instead conclude that turnout depends on relative education. People vote not because they're educated, but because they're more educated than others. This once again suggests peer effects. The longer you stay in school, the more politically active your social circle, and the more politically active you become to fit in. Suppose you're convinced voting enriches the soul. As long as relative education is what counts, education redistributes the enrichment rather than creating it. Schooling one more person makes them more likely to experience the wonder of democratic participation, but also makes the rest of the citizenry less likely to partake in the wonder. The modern lifestyle. Culture and politics aside, we have stereotypes about education's effect on lifestyle. The well-educated favor the modern way of life. The less educated, the traditional way of life. The modern are secular and bohemian, with few children. The traditional are religious and stodgy, with many children. Schools may not loudly favor modernity over tradition, but perhaps they subtly turn their students into modern men and modern women nonetheless. Education could be good for the soul because it frees us from the dead hand of the past. Or not. For all their appeal, stereotypes about education and modernity are unreliable. By the numbers, the well-educated are more modern in some ways, more traditional in others. Religion. Stereotypes say the well-educated are less religious, but this is a half-truth. The well-educated are less religious theologically. As education goes up, faith in God and the literal truth of the Bible recedes. Yet the well-educated are more religious sociologically. As education goes up, so do church membership and church attendance. These are well-established patterns, at least in the United States. Statistical corrections make education's theological effect look smaller, but its sociological effect look bigger. The General Social Survey measures Americans' confidence in God's existence on a 1-6 scale. 1 equals, I don't believe in God. 6 equals, I know God really exists and I have no doubts about it. And religious attendance on a 0-8 scale. 0 equals never. 8 equals more than once a week. After correcting for income, intelligence, social status, demographics, and time, a year of education reduces faith in God by 0.04 steps, but increases religious attendance by 0.06 steps. Global studies of religion typically conclude intelligence reduces both forms of religiosity, but education's effect on religion remains fuzzy. The only clear-cut evidence that education seriously undermines religion comes from former communist countries, where curricula, not to mention governments themselves, were harshly atheistic. How can education, including college, matter so little for religion? Sociologists Eucher, Regnerus, and Waller paint a plausibly cynical picture. Some students have elected not to engage in the intellectual life around them. They are on campus to pursue an applicable degree, among other, more mundane pursuits, and not to wrestle with issues of morality or meaning. They instead stick to what they need to know, that which will be on the exam. Such students are numerous, and as a result, students' own religious faith or lack of it faces little challenge. What is not contested, then, cannot be lost. All this is unsurprising, given how little youths know about their religions in the first place. While higher education opens up new worlds for students who apply themselves, it can, but does not often, create skepticism about old religious worlds, or at least not among most American young people, in part because students themselves do not perceive a great deal of competition between higher education and faith. And also because very many young Americans are so under-socialized in their religious faith before college begins that they would have difficulty recognizing faith-challenging material when it appears. None of this shows education is inherently religiously impotent. Perhaps heavy-handed parochial or atheistic education would spur widespread conversion or apostasy. Actually existing education's religious effects are, however, mixed and weak. Marriage and divorce. Since the 1940s, lifelong marriage retreated as education advanced. Have schools sapped our traditional values in favor of bohemian permissiveness? Unlikely. Despite bohemian trends, education, marriage, and divorce are tenuously linked. In the modern United States, getting married is slightly more common for male college grads, but slightly less common for female college grads. Being married is more common for all college grads because graduates of both sexes are now less likely to divorce. Yet on closer look, the patterns blur. Americans who start college but fail to finish are less likely to marry and more likely to divorce than Americans who avoid college altogether. American women with advanced degrees are less likely to be married than American women who stop after the BA. Looking back in time or around the world further blurs the story. Until recent decades, educated American women tended to stay single. Internationally, the well-educated are less likely to marry in some countries, but more likely to marry in others. The same holds for divorce. How much of education's surface effect is genuine? Evidence is thin, but researchers who try to statistically isolate education's effects usually learn that, at least in the modern United States, education truly fosters marriage. In the General Social Survey, estimated effects are small but solid, at least for the last two decades. Correcting for demographics, intelligence, church attendance, and era, each year of education raises the chance of being married by 0.7 percentage points and reduces the chance of being divorced by 0.3 percentage points. Overall, then, friends of traditional marriage have little to fear from education. While its effect is uneven, time in school now seems to make Americans less bohemian. As usual, peer effects are the go-to mechanism. Humans care far more about how their social equals are living today than what their teachers said or insinuated years ago. Consistent with this story, social class fully accounts for education's effects on marriage and divorce in modern America. Staying in school gets individuals into the elite club, which in turn helps them get married and avoid divorce. When everyone stays in school longer, however, the elite club jacks up its membership requirements, leaving the prevalence of marriage unchanged. Fertility. Educated people have fewer kids. Few demographic laws are more strictly enforced. This law doesn't fit just the modern United States. High education countries are less fertile than low education countries, and countries' fertility erodes as education advances, at least since 1900. Fertility gaps are big. Averaging over the world, low education women outbreed high education women by about one-third. Nation by nation, disparities of a full child or more are common. In principle, education could be a mask for income, intelligence, status, democratization, or modernization. When statistically challenged, though, education stays strong. To illustrate, take the United States from 1972 to 2012. During this era, each year of education seems to cut Americans' fertility by 0.12 children. After statistically correcting for income, intelligence, demographics, and era, one year of education still seems to prevent 0.10 births. While education cools fertility for both sexes, it cools women's more. Wives' education matters three or four times as much as husbands'. Does education sway childbearing via leadership or peer effects? The leadership story is straightforward. Almost all schools, even schools that never mention birth control, explicitly urge students to delay childbearing. And most schools at least insinuate that high-powered careers are better than big families. Peer effects make sense, too. Look at the baby boom. Globally, the mix remains unclear. At least in the modern United States, however, peer effects seem weak. Even though social class fully explains education's effects on marriage and divorce, social class explains none of education's effects on fertility. Dropouts who climb into the upper class still breed like dropouts. PhDs who stumble into the lower class still breed like PhDs. When schools prompt their students to have fewer kids, then, they're plausibly prompting society to have fewer kids, too. Education leads society toward a less populous future. Out of all the educational consequences we've scrutinized, this is the most impressive. The key question, are these consequences impressively good or impressively bad? If you're convinced every country on Earth is overpopulated, education's antinatal effect is a great point in its favor. Anyone who accepts the dangers of low fertility, however, should tremble. Almost all developed countries are below replacement fertility. Germany, Japan, and Russia's populations have fallen already. Many other lands will join them in coming decades. Even worse, education doesn't just sap overall population. It targets the educational elite, because the people most inclined to linger in school restrict their childbearing the most. Whatever weight you put on human capital versus signaling, or nature versus nurture, this is demographically perverse. The flip side, happily, is that governments can apparently make babies with budget cuts, arresting their demographic troubles for less than nothing. Broadening horizons. I've been griping about curricula since kindergarten. Whenever teachers gave stupid assignments, I voiced my malcontent to teachers and parents alike. Their standard response, even the stupidest assignments, serve the higher purpose of broadening horizons. The world is rich with possibilities, yet most students are poor in curiosity. Teachers have a sacred duty to make close-minded youths sample this cornucopia. Academic tasting menus don't just enrich students emotionally. They enrich students vocationally by exposing them to overlooked career paths. In hindsight, the teachers and parents' theory was sound. Kids are closed-minded, and schools can help them by nudging them to try new things. Unfortunately, educators misapply this noble theory. Rhetoric aside, educators are as narrow-minded as kids. Most of the items on the academic tasting menu have the same stale flavor, unsurprising since teachers typically teach whatever they were taught. When schools decry narrow-mindedness, their real goal is to replace students' narrowness with their own. Think about what passes for broadening students' horizons. Teachers expose students to an ossified list of subjects: music, art, poetry, drama, foreign language, history, government, dance, sports. Some kids respond eagerly, especially to music and sports. Yet the greater their excitement, the greater their ultimate disappointment. Almost no one grows up to be a violinist, painter, poet, actor, historian, politician, ballet dancer, or professional athlete. More importantly, all the kids who respond eagerly to none of the above must wait until college for the mandatory broadening to relent. The alternative? For starters, give students numerous and diverse options. Instead of making students study yet another American poem, expose them to Japanese graphic novels. Rather than forcing kids to perform one more play, show them a few films from the 1980s. When you run out of ideas, assign a random Wikipedia article. If you want to help kids discover what emotionally clicks for them, trial and error beats academic tradition cold. Anyone who calls Japanese comic books and old movies useless should check their double standard. How are comic books and movies any more useless than poems and plays? All else equal, of course, exposing students to plausible careers is better than exposing them to mere hobbies. To live the adage, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life, students must learn what lovable jobs are available. Give students numerous, diverse, yet realistic options. Start with the Bureau of Labor Statistics figures on employment by major occupational group and occupations with the most job growth. Expose boys to nursing. Introduce strong math students to insurance. Tell upper-middle-class kids what plumbers and electricians do and earn. See how many students try Python programming if it fulfills their foreign language requirement. When you run out of ideas, have students check out an unfamiliar job from the Bureau of Labor Statistics Occupational Outlook Handbook. The fact that schools probably won't try any of these reforms teaches us a sad truth about actually existing education. Broadening horizons is a slogan educators use to squelch students' sensible doubts. If educators really wanted to broaden students' horizons, curricula would give students a tour of what the world has to offer, not a tour of what educators were forced to learn when they were students. The merit of play. Rather than give children 30 minutes to while away the time as they please, he said, it makes more sense to teach them a skill, like dancing or gymnastics. New York Times on Atlanta Schools Superintendent Dr. Benjamin Canada. Education can be glorious. At its best, to quote Roman philosopher Lucretius, it is a voyage in mind throughout infinity. But education is not the sole glorious experience. Since students have only 24 hours a day, even the finest studies risk crowding out competing experiences of greater worth. What could possibly outshine the wonders of education? It is tempting to focus on prestigious activities like writing a killer app or training for the Olympics. Students' most relevant competing experience, though, is play, savoring the joys of youth. The more time and effort students devote to their studies, the less remains for carefree exploration of their world. Recall the classic back-to-school essay, What I Did on My Summer Vacation. Some kids fritter away their free months watching reality TV in a lonely basement, but plenty of others bond with grandparents or cousins, collect seashells, play Dungeons and Dragons with friends, or travel the country. If kids spent more time in school, some of this enrichment would be lost. If kids spent less time in school, can there be any doubt that more of this enrichment would be gained? Psychologist Peter Gray could well be the world's greatest spokesman for the merit of free play. Kids have more fun and learn vital lessons when adults give them their space. Playing well and having fun are more important than winning is a line often used by Little League coaches after a loss, rarely after a win. But with spectators watching, with a trophy on the line, and with so much attention paid to the score, one has to wonder how many of the players believe that line, and how many secretly think that Vince Lombardi had it right. The view that winning is the only thing becomes even more prominent as one moves up to high school and then to college sports. In informal sports, playing well and having fun really are more important than winning. Everyone knows that. You don't have to try to convince anyone with a lecture. And you can play regardless of your level of skill. The whole point of an informal game is to have fun and stretch your own skills, sometimes in new and creative ways that would be disallowed or jeered at in a formal game. If you are a better player than the others, these are ways to self-handicap, which make the game more interesting for everyone. In a formal game, where winning matters, you could never do such things. You would be accused of betraying your team. The lesson isn't that all play and no school are best for kids. The lesson is that champions of academic soul craft shouldn't fixate on education. Instead, they should seek out what mix of school and play is best for the soul. Unfortunately, thanks to the high status of education and the low status of play, we tend to compare school at its best to play at its worst. Another hour of Angry Birds can't compete with a Shakespeare lecture from the teacher Robin Williams played in Dead Poets Society. The smart way to discover the best mix of school and play, though, is to compare school and play as they really are. Both fall short of their promise, but it's unclear which falls shorter. Still, there's little reason to favor a dominant role for education over play, and in our society, education dominates children's days. School and study time has been high and growing for decades. According to leading tabulations of 6 to 12-year-olds' schedules, weekly school and study time rose from about 31 hours in 1981 to 37 hours in 1997 and 2003. Playtime is small by comparison, about 10 hours a week. Play counts computer games, but excludes TV time, which fell from over 18 hours in 1981 to 14 hours in 2003. Outdoor play has atrophied over the last generation. 70% of mothers say they played outside every day when they were kids, while only 31% of their children do the same. Only a small minority of elementary schools have abolished recess, but one major study found 20% of school districts trimmed it during the first 5 years of the No Child Left Behind Act. Virtually no district made recess longer. Longer school days do serve one socially useful function. They warehouse kids so both their parents can work. But more hours in school needn't mean more hours of school. Schools could have used kids' extra campus hours to expand recess. Indeed, if they wanted kids to keep some independence, they could have offered an array of fun yet frugal options in lieu of extra class time. My pet cause? Keep the school library open so studious and intellectually curious kids have a tranquil place for free reading. Until college, every school I ever attended had a well-stocked library that was almost never open to the student body. Free play takes many forms. Why not turn the library into a bookworm's sanctuary? For college kids, you may recall, playtime is now longer than ever. The college workload slimmed down as K through 12s bulked up. Most critics of modern education take this as a tragic fall in standards, but once you accept the merit of play, the rise of Leisure College USA is a blessing in disguise. College gives students ample time for carefree exploration, time they rarely had in childhood. Plenty of undergrads fritter away their opportunity in a drunken stupor, yet others sample a medley of fascinating options, acquiring passions that last a lifetime. My undergraduate years were my favorites precisely because classes were so undemanding. Every day was packed with hours for play, and play I did. I read philosophy, listened to opera, wargamed with my friends, and argued politics with strangers past midnight. I owe my soul to lax academic standards. The cynical idealist. Economists are a cynical bunch. Most are tone-deaf to the humanist thesis that education enriches the soul. They studiously measure education's career benefits. They grant education has consumption benefits. Yet most balk at claims about education's intrinsic worth. When humanists face my calculations of education's selfish and social returns, my calls for educational austerity and vocational training, they assume I'm being a typical cynical economist, oblivious to the transformative ideals so many educators hold dear. I am an economist, and I am a cynic, but I'm not a typical cynical economist. I'm a cynical idealist. I embrace the ideal of transformative education. I believe wholeheartedly in the life of the mind. What I'm cynical about is people. I'm cynical about students. The vast majority are Philistines. The best teachers in the universe couldn't inspire them with sincere and lasting love of ideas and culture. I'm cynical about teachers. The vast majority are uninspiring. They can't convince even themselves to love ideas and culture, much less their students. I'm cynical about deciders, the school officials who control what students study. The vast majority think they've done their job as long as students obey. Anyone who searches their memory will find noble exceptions to these sad rules. I know plenty of eager students and passionate educators, and I know of a few wise deciders. They're the salt of the earth. Still, my 40 years in the education industry, many at the best schools in the world, leave no doubt that eager students, passionate educators, and wise deciders are hopelessly outnumbered. Meritorious education survives but does not thrive. I don't hate education. Rather, I love education too much to accept our Orwellian substitute. What's Orwellian about the status quo? Most fundamentally, the idea of compulsory enlightenment. Educators routinely defend compulsion on the grounds that few students want to explore ideas and culture. They're right about the students' tastes, but forget a deeper truth. Intrinsically valuable education requires eager students. Mandatory study of ideas and culture spoils the journey. Even if you bite the end justifies the means bullet, compulsory enlightenment yields little enlightenment. For all their Orwellian self-congratulation, schools are unconvincing. Despite auspicious conditions, they fail to make either high culture or liberal politics noticeably more popular. Regimentation may be a good way to mold external behavior, but it's a bad way to win hearts and minds, and a terrible way to foster thoughtful commitment. As Stanford education professor David Labari remarks, motivating volunteers to engage in human improvement is very difficult, as any psychotherapist can confirm, but motivating conscripts is quite another thing altogether. And it is conscripts that teachers face every day in the classroom. Even top students respond to incentivized soulcraft by gaming the system, not reforming their priorities. Unlike those in the United States, British universities essentially base admissions on academic performance. When British professor Greg Clark began teaching at Stanford University, his elite American students looked like better human beings than their British counterparts. He soon learned Americans' superiority was a ruse. In my second year as an assistant professor at Stanford University, I was assigned the task of mentoring six freshmen. Each appeared on paper to have an incredible range of interests for an 18-year-old. Chess club, debate club, history club, running team, volunteering with homeless shelters. I soon discovered that these supposed interests were just an artifact of the U.S. college admission process, adopted to flesh out the application forms and discarded as soon as they have worked their magic. Still, humanists should not despair. The savior of transformative education has arrived, the Internet, the merit machine. Though online education isn't poised to put brick-and-mortar schools out of business, it already beats traditional education in the quest for enlightenment. The Internet enlightens the money poor. Out-of-pocket cost is near zero. The Internet enlightens the time poor. Commuting cost is normally zero, too. The Internet enlightens the intellectually isolated. Search engines and ratings mark the most promising autodidactic paths. Many idealists object that the Internet provides enlightenment for only those who seek it. They're right, but petulant to ask for more. Enlightenment is a state of mind, not a skill. And state of mind, unlike skill, is easily faked. When schools require enlightenment, students predictably respond by feigning interest in ideas and culture, giving educators a false sense of accomplishment. When enlightenment is optional, in contrast, educators' failure to transform their students is undeniable. Cynics may lose whatever hope they had left, but cynical idealists will wonder, how can we do better? The obvious responses are better pedagogy and better marketing. This isn't wishful thinking. Online education, broadly defined, refines pedagogy and marketing every day. Educators' less obvious response is broadening the audience. Most humans intrigued by abstract ideas and high culture are working adults. Instead of lamenting youthful apathy, passionate educators should redirect their energy to humans who are ready for enlightenment. There is little money in blogging, podcasting, or uploading lectures to YouTube, but if, like me, you love education to the depths of your soul, such efforts are their own reward. Chapter 10. Five Chats on Education and Enlightenment. I've learned much about education by experience. I've learned more by reading research. Neither experience nor research feels complete, however, without discussion and argument. Conversations about education are reliably engaging because, unlike conversations about, say, offshore oil drilling, no one's in the dark. Few read education research, but virtually every adult's been to school and had a job. Unfortunately, most arguments about education are insular. Researchers pay little attention to laymen's firsthand experiences. Indeed, they're dismissive on principle. You can't believe what people say. Laymen pay even less attention to researchers' high-tech analyses. You can prove anything with statistics. My ambition in the case against education is to merge all the evidence, the testimony of students, parents, workers, teachers, and employers, as well as research in economics, psychology, sociology, and education. Though I can heed everyone, I cannot please everyone. Rather than try to placate any one faction, this chapter brings them all together for a battle royale. The following dialogues are inspired by three decades of arguments about education. I'm the only real character. The rest are archetypes, composites, though hopefully not caricatures, of my favorite critics. The cast. Brian Kaplan, professor of economics at George Mason University, highest credential, PhD in economics from Princeton University. James Cooper, freshman at the University of Kansas, major undeclared, highest credential, diploma from Topeka High School. Frederick Dodd, columnist for the Wall Street Journal, blogger for the Chronicle of Higher Education, highest credential, MA in journalism from New York University. Alan Lang, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, highest credential, PhD in economics from MIT. Jillian Morgan, freelance tech journalist, highest credential, BS in computer science from UCLA. Cynthia Reagan, English teacher at Woodrow Wilson High School, New Jersey, highest credential, BA in English from the College of New Jersey. Derek Romano, recent high school dropout, highest credential, none. Gretchen Simpson, student loan activist, highest credential, MA in sociology from the University of Florida. Daria Stein, entrepreneur and parent of a high school junior, highest credential, BS in engineering from the University of Texas. Chat number one, education, what it's good for. Derek, let me get this straight. You're a teacher who admits school is a big waste of time. I'm the smart one for quitting high school after every adult in my life told me not to. Brian, not quite. Selfishly speaking, you shot yourself in the foot. Though you'll never need to know most of what you missed in school, you'll still bear an ugly stigma in the job market. Alan, he's going to bear an ugly stigma because he quit school before he learned the basic skills workers need in the modern economy. Cynthia, right, Alan. Brian's position is plain irresponsible. Kids like Derek need to know school is the path out of poverty. Brian, I don't deny schooling pays decently in the job market. I claim rather that schooling pays mainly by signaling employability, not by raising employability. If Derek obtained his high school diploma without learning anything he doesn't already know, his job prospects would be much brighter. Cynthia, odd claim for a professor with a PhD from Princeton. Brian, I'm a whistleblower. Without my prestigious credentials, would you even listen to my case against education? And what I'm saying is anything but odd. You see it with your own eyes. Tell me, Cynthia, what are you teaching your kids this week? Cynthia, after a pause, the poetry of T.S. Eliot. Brian, ah, the hollow men. When will your students ever use T.S. Eliot on the job? Cynthia, who knows? Any one of them could become a poet or literary critic. Brian, I'm guessing you've taught about 3,500 students in your lifetime. As far as you've heard, have any of your students found employment in poetry, literary criticism, or anything else that taps their knowledge of Eliot's oeuvre? Alan, not a fair question. Who knows what job skills poetry builds? Instead of relying on our intuition about what subjects are useful, we should see what passes the market test. If employers are more interested in applicants with good grades in English, who are you to deny the usefulness of Eliot's work? Brian, his poetry passes a market test. The nature of the test, however, is ambiguous. While knowing Eliot's poetry is conceivably a useful job skill, it's more likely to signal pre-existing job skills. Cynthia, why does it matter? My students won't use Eliot on the job, but they need good grades to get a job. If they don't do the assigned work, they won't get good grades. Alan, it doesn't matter for your students, but it matters for society. If teachers only affix labels to students' foreheads, we might as well cut the labeling process short, save a pile of time and money, and let students assume their adult roles earlier. Once we concede Brian's signaling nonsense, it's game over. Brian, how is it nonsense? Alan, school is packed with useful material, reading, writing, math. It's not all signaling. Brian, I never said all. My thesis is that the education premium is mostly signaling, not entirely signaling. That's why I spill so much ink trying to quantify the human capital signaling breakdown. Derek, you're reminding me why I dropped out. Professor, please speak English. Brian, sorry, I picked up bad habits from my teachers. Derek, you agree extra education can help you get a better job and make more money, right? Derek, yeah, because employers care more about a scrap of paper than what you can do. Brian, you're getting ahead of me. When education raises your income, economists call that the education premium. Part of the premium exists because school makes you more productive. That's the human capital share. The rest of the premium exists because school makes you look more productive. That's the signaling share. The human capital signaling breakdown is both shares side by side. 70-30 means 70% human capital, 30%